slap on your war paint, girder your kilts, and don't forget to decapitate your enemies. It's Film Shake, the 90s movies podcast. I'm Jordan.
And this is Nick.
And today we're at episode 45. It's a special request from Nick's mom, Miss Annie. Hello, and thank you for your patronage. This is Braveheart from 1995.
Yes, and happy birthday, Mom. Her birthday is actually the day after we're recording this, which is pretty crazy serendipity. Very nice.
Right, so this will be like a late birthday present for her.
Yes.
For your mom. While we talk about this very bloody, brutal movie that I guess she's really into, so good for her.
Yeah.
But before we do that, Nick, as always, I lost the trivia battle. Oh, wait, did I? No. We didn't really have a trivia battle. Wait, I'm just assuming I lost because I lose so often. That's a shame. That's such a shame. Yes. Last time, if you tune into our previous episode, you didn't hear us. You heard our good friends Doug and Jamie from the Good Times Great Movies podcast for a little April Fool's switcheroo. So they covered Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, and their punishment movie was Spice Girls, but they decided not to do a trivia battle and just make us, or maybe just me, I don't know if you watched this, Nick, but we decided since we're doing Mel Gibson with Braveheart, we're going to do his 2020 film, Fat Man. Nick, did you watch this with me?
Jordan, it's a 2020 film starring Mel Gibson as Santa Claus, where Walton Goggins hunts him down in an attempt to assassinate him called Fat Man. You bet your ass I watched this, Jordan. You bet your jiggly, cookie-eating ass I watched this movie.
Well, I had a question first. So, it is 2022. Are we allowed to say any nice things about Mel Gibson now?
Oh, Jordan. Like,
I'm not sure what the protocol is now.
Jordan, I've written a statement for this episode.
Okay,
I got you covered. You ready for this?
All right.
Mel Gibson has a laundry list of incidents of shameful behavior, particularly when he was in the worst throes of alcoholism. Originally, I had an entire spiel I was ready to give about him. Should I say spiel or spiel, Jordan? What do you think is better?
I would go with the spiel.
Okay, let's go spiel? With spiel. That's right.
Whoa. Okay, let's see what you're doing there. All right.
I was ready to give about him and his moral failings. I had a whole thing ready, Jordan. But then, Jordan, the biggest star of the 90s, our very decade, who is not Mel Gibson, assaulted someone on live television. Then, minutes later, minutes after that, he received a Best Actor award and a standing ovation, Jordan. You know, they could have just gave him the award and everyone maybe just, like, watched in silence or just lightly clapped. No, Jordan, they gave Will Smith a standing ovation.
Yes.
So at this point, I feel like Hollywood has proven over time, time and time again, to be a morally corrupt system that props up sexual predators like Harvey Weinstein for decades, and where even the biggest heroes like Tom Hanks, he's America's dad, right? Well, you know what? He's also a real dad, Jordan, and one of his sons is a huge asshole who can't stay out of the news. So on those grounds, Mel Gibson is, in my opinion, one of the best working directors in Hollywood, and I think his three-film run with Braveheart, The Passion, and Apocalypto could nearly rival P.T. Anderson's run of Magnolia, Punch-Drunk Love, There Will Be Blood, or Fincher's run of Seven, The Game and Fight Club, or even Sofia Coppola's run of Virgin Suicides, Lost in Translation, and Marie Antoinette.
Not that I disagree with you, but I just feel like we're going to get immediate hate mail now from anybody.
Look, okay, for all of his issues, and they are legion, this man can direct a film, and he's not a bad actor either. And of all the people that we talk about in all these movies, this is a system full of narcissists and criminals, people doing horrible things behind closed doors, and the bad things Mel Gibson did just happen to all get recorded. You know, I'm not propping him up at all or making excuses about his behavior, but by the nature of our show, we're only here to talk about his actual work. And when he was actually working, it seems like everyone who was working with him enjoyed the experience and had nothing but great things to say about him. So is this a guy a bad guy? Well, he's definitely done some really horrible things. I can say with I think 100% surety. Neither you or I have been pulled over while drunk and then called the arresting officer sugar tits. I don't think that's happened. And then gone.
No, I mean, not in this lifetime.
Yes. Unless we were reincarnated from Mel Gibson and came back to right now. We've never done that.
That's right.
And then gone on racist spiels. We haven't done that.
We've been introduced to the Bowdie ball, so, you know.
That's right.
The Patrick Swayze glowing alien ball. Anything could happen.
Yes.
But, I mean, you know, it seemed like he was on ice for like a decade, right? He just wasn't doing anything. And then now things have started to thaw. He, you know, made Hacksaw Ridge. He was nominated for Academy Awards. But, you know, I don't know, have things evolved that quickly, or it used to be a decade to thaw, but like you said, Will Smith slapped somebody on national television and then a minute later got an award. So, I mean, obviously he's facing some fallout now, so, you know, people aren't happy with him. But, I mean, how long is that going to last? I don't know. Time will tell, I suppose. But, yes, we do have to separate the art from the artist here and, you know, just look at the work, like you said. He's a great director and a pretty good actor. So how about we get into some Fat Man then?
Yes, because I'd feel like a huge hypocrite with some of the people that we've covered. Just even the subject matter from, what was that? What's the really bad movie? Wild Wild West. Jordan, I cut when I edited that episode, I had to cut out minutes upon minutes of dialogue of us just talking about dialogue that was in that film because of how racially offensive it was. Like, that was horrible.
Yeah.
I feel like I would be a huge hypocrite to be like, but Mel Gibson, we can't talk about anything he's ever laid hands on, even if thousands of crew members worked on that film and did their best work that they won Oscars for. We can't talk about it because Mel Gibson made it, which I'm just not on board. Yeah. And I have a lot of respect for Doug and what he said because, I agree. And based on things that he has done, Mel Gibson is a piece of shit, but he's also a great director who's made some great films. So let's talk about a movie where he plays Santa Claus and someone tries to kill him. And he also has alcohol problems and firearms. And let's go. Let's talk about this.
Yeah. Like how close to home could you get? I don't know. It's like skirting the lines there. So Fat Man, man, it was actually better than I expected. I went in with low expectations, and it went to some weird and unique places that I did not see coming. So, like we said, the story's about Mel Gibson playing this kind of rough and tumble, down on his luck, very disgruntled Santa Claus. And when a preppy little rich kid gets some coal in his stocking, because he's basically just, you know, a piece of trash human, he decides to put a hit out on Santa. The hitman, like you said, being Walter Goggins, who is just incredible in this, actually. He plays this hitman who's also obsessed with Santa, and he has a vendetta with the Fat Man. So, the trailer makes this look like an unhinged kind of blood fest, like this just kind of wacky black humor type of film that just goes off the rails the whole time. And it's really only like that in the last, what would you say, like 20 minutes maybe?
Yeah, and it doesn't even really go off the rails. It's just like,
no.
It's like a solid big action shootout and then like a more intimate, really tense one-on-one, well, mostly one-on-one shootout. So yeah, man, I can't believe this, Jordan. I feel like we're going to agree this whole episode. I'm just sensing it right now.
I'm just kind of blown away by the territory this movie covers, and it goes to places where Santa's elves, you know, they're basically shown as factory workers and how the factory, the workshop, is going to have to be shut down since their check from the government is smaller this year due to the contract stating they only get paid for how many presents they produce. And since the world's numbers of little asshole kids are on the uptick, then less presents means less money for Santa. And the elves, you know, it just might lead to this big shutdown. But the government wants to use Santa's operations for military purposes, and they're going to buy him out and have the elves build control panels for fighter jets. Yes, all of that is actually in this movie, this hour and a half movie about a hitman trying to kill Santa. I'm just pretty amazed that they fit all these little subplots in here into a movie that, you know, by the trailer, I just thought was going to be utterly terrible. And maybe that sounds utterly terrible to some people. I don't know. But, you know, some of the best stuff is just Goggins. He's playing it completely tongue in cheek. He's, you know, I don't know if I'd call him over the top, but he's so serious and dedicated to a role that is absolutely absurd.
Right, and I've loved this guy since he was in The Shield, when he played Shane, who was kind of a loose cannon, kind of screw-up guy. He was amazing in that, and then he went on to do Justified, where he played Boyd. And he's just did so many great things in television, and then he jumped to the big screen, and man, he's just so good in every role he plays, and he's great in this. Like, it's just... it's not any kind of, like, stereotypical phoning-it-in type performance. Like, this is a very uniquely specific performance. It's really good.
I think that was what really won me over, is how specific they make all this world. You know, the specifics of, like I said, the factory and the elves and the workshop, and the specifics of Santa and Mrs. Claus' relationship. The specifics of the little boy Billy, who puts a hit out on him and is, you know, he's stealing money from his grandmother, and he's like kidnapping this girl who won the science fair project and beat him out, and all the, you know, just all these little weird, like, idiosyncratic details that were really great. And, you know, the fact that Walter Goggins plays this, you know, super, like, you know, badass, like, super serious hitman, but he's also paying people big money for toys that were made from Santa's workshop, because he's this, like, weird collector of all this stuff, because he, I guess he was a twisted kid, and he always got coal in his stocking, too, so he's out to, like, gather these toys and these objects that he could never attain. So, I don't know, just got a lot of weird stuff going for it. He carries around a hamster in a cage with him as he's traveling to the North Pole to kill Santa. I don't know, it's just a weird movie, but it strangely, it works, and I felt like, you know, Mel Gibson, he's still an engaging performer. You know, he does a really good job as the old gnarled Santa. And Marianne Jean-Baptiste plays this very nurturing Mrs. Claus. So, I don't know, I just had a lot more fun with it than I expected. You know, there was a little bit of the weight of, like, seeing Mel Gibson again more recently, and, like, you know, knowing these kind of past controversies with him and stuff, and feeling like maybe the movie was nodding to some of that in a way. Did you feel that way at all?
Yeah, definitely with certain aspects, that grizzled aspect of his character, how he's kind of become jaded. But again, like, I thought they were just going to go full bore into that, like he was going to be an alcoholic and he was just going to lose it and become, like, mindlessly violent. But it's such a sensitive movie. It doesn't do that, right? Like, he just drinks a little too much, and his wife gently nudges him to dial it back. And then he does, which, Jordan, the marriage in this movie, that's what sold me on this. That's what sold me that he and Marianne Jean-Baptiste, who is in the second season of Broadchurch, she's so good in that. She's the lawyer, and she's just, I thought, amazing in that. And she's really great in this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she also, like, don't mess with her Santa. You know, she's got his back. Right. I really appreciated that. The ending of this movie, I really, really enjoyed. And it wasn't what I expected either, man. I thought it was going to be, like, really over the top and very, very, like, comedic. And I maybe laughed 3 or 4 times, but it was really almost more of a serious drama with a lot of weird stuff in there, and, like, some strange, highly specific attentions to detail. So, yeah, I didn't think it was, like, a great movie, but it was, like, a solid 6 out of 10 for me, where I wasn't, like, thinking 5 at all, like, closer to 7 than 5, so... yeah, I enjoyed it, man.
Yeah, I did, speaking of the comedic elements, I did have to bust out, I had to bust out laughing. I just had to at the end of this movie, which I'm pretty sure it's done intentionally, but just how dark it goes with where he goes with Santa. And, you know, spoiler alert, if anybody wants to go out and watch this movie and, you know, not have it spoiled right here, you know, maybe you weren't planning on watching Fat Man from 2020, but... hopefully, you know, you'll give it a shot. But yeah, so spoiler alert, skip past this. But Santa, he ends up, you know, killing the hitman. He tracks the hit back to the little boy Billy, the preppy kid, and he shows up at the kid's house, his eyeball shot through. He's just, you know, like, this bloody eyeball hanging out. And he's basically tells the kid, like, I've decided to be proactive, and it starts with you. Like, basically all the kids in the world are growing up crap. Like, so he's just going to start getting proactive. And he tells them, one more time, Billy, one more, and you'll be getting more than coal in your stocking. I'm coming back. I'll come while you sleep and rip you from your covers. By my head, you will know the consequence of your actions, so don't screw it up. The fat man's got his eye on you, kid.
I watched that part twice.
So dark. I know, you have to watch that twice, because it just gets so dark, where basically he's just like, you know, Santa feels like he's lost his influence, and these kids are just growing up crap. Well, he's going to take matters into his own hands, and it's going to be like an eye for an eye from now on, kid. Just completely insane, but I don't know, it just felt right, and it was hilarious. So definitely boosted my rating for that movie right there. For rating, I'd probably give it like a 3 out of 5. Yeah, solid. Pretty solid. Like I said, like you said, it wasn't a great movie, but, you know, there was, especially just like the touches of Walter Goggins driving across Canada to go to the North Pole. And they had like some cool editing choices, you know, as he's like listening to different songs and like cutting from one town to another. And is he like eating different things or listening to different things, doing different things? I don't know. Just like, I could have had a whole movie of that, of him just like on this road trip to kill Santa.
Yeah, that was really well done, man. I'm kind of sad that the Nelmses, I think it's the brothers that wrote and directed this, I'm kind of sad that they haven't really done much more stuff other than this. But I know this is kind of a recent movie, but I don't think critics quite got it. And again, I do think there are probably critics who are like, oh, Mel Gibson's in this. Well, screw this movie. I'll watch 5 minutes of it and then write this shitty review for it. And I think this is just a solid movie. I don't really see how you could like say it sucks. I mean, like you might be bored with it if you were expecting like some kind of gonzo thing, but it's a solid flick.
Yeah, it is solid. Honestly, I watched the trailer, showed it to my wife, and, you know, we were both just like, oh my gosh, this looks like a bad time. This does not look good at all. And so I was pleasantly surprised that it was as well done as it was. So that, you know, in that whole speech at the end, I was gonna say almost as good as one of Gibson's famous speeches in Braveheart. I don't know, you know, not really, but this is one segue to another, I guess. Now we can get into Braveheart, 1995.
Okay. We're talking about Braveheart, man, so you gotta do it like this. We're talking about 1995. Now, how do I do this right? You can't. There's no way to do it right. 1995's Braveheart. Damn it.
Wait, I got it. Hold. 1995 Braveheart.
You nailed it. Nailed it. Dude, Braveheart. Braveheart, man.
So Braveheart.
This is our second Best Picture winner that we've talked about. And you know what? When we go on another show.
What was the first?
It was Titanic, man. Like I said, you know, we only cover like the kind of crappier movies of the 90s. But that's not true. I'm not going to even say that anymore, man. We cover everything. Any 90s movie.
We do.
All of them.
From the terrible to the awesome.
Yeah.
That's right. But yeah, I mean, we do cover a lot of, like, I don't know, it feels like a lot of the movies that we cover, we can usually get sillier with. But watching this, I was like, oh yeah, it's going to be one of those episodes. It's going to be one of those probably more serious episodes, but I'll try and throw in some ridiculousness for you.
I don't think it'll be that hard.
Right. I mean, we've got boobs. We've got boobs and kilts.
Braveheart, boobs and kilts. Jordan Courtney, 2022.
2022. That's going to be the name of the remake that I make in 2025. Boobs and Kilts.
Mel Gibson is too controversial. We got to remake this film. It's going to be called Boobs and Kilts. Hey, just completely off the rails. BK Knights. Remember when that was like the prize for being on any kid's game show in the 90s? Like you win a pair of BK Knights. Do you remember those shoes?
I don't remember that.
Man, if you were on Legends of the Hidden Temple and you didn't win,
I remember that.
Got a pair of BK Knights, man. They were just giving those things away like candy.
You didn't win, but here's some BK Knights.
Yeah, that's right. They couldn't have been that good. Yeah, you talk so I can Google BK Knights. Go ahead, man.
So I must have seen this movie when I was 9 years old, and I maybe watched it a couple times since then, but, you know, firm memory in my brain of watching it at 9, and I'm like, watching it now, I'm like, dang, dude, like, I watched this when I was 9 years old. I like how the MPAA rating for this is, quote-unquote, brutal medieval violence. Like, not just brutal violence, but brutal medieval violence, because I guess they had to get specific and tell you what time period the violence was from. I don't see brutal modern violence on the R rating for John Wick. Maybe it's like the expression, I'ma get medieval on your ass. That was like a 90s thing, right?
Yeah, sure. That was from the 90s, buddy.
Sure.
And it came from this movie.
Yeah, from this movie. Yeah, they said that in this movie, I'm sure. Just in the background. But, you know, to get serious, the violence in here is quite brutal, and it is medieval. And the medieval, you know, description helps you anticipate that you're going to see a guy's skull splatter as he's hit in the face with a spiked mace. So, yeah, I guess, you know, they probably did need to put brutal medieval violence.
Jordan, I don't know if you know this. And also, well, first thing, I don't know if you know this, but they still make BK Knights. They're still around. They're more of a specialty item now. Yeah, definitely.
All right.
And the second thing is, so obviously I'm Nick from Filmshake, and I bought this on 4K Blu-ray, and I watched all 17 hours of extras.
I know you did.
And this movie was originally far more violent than it is. And Gibson and the editor actually found that if they cut out the more graphic shots, but did other things with the editing and made the more moderate violence relentless, it actually felt more violent than the more gratuitous shots did.
Hmm.
I mean, it's still very, very violent, but just think, Jordan, it could have been even more violent, because for the ending, obviously we go full spoilers on the show, but in real life, whenever he got killed, whenever William Wallace was executed, dude, they cut off his junk, man. They cut off all his junk, and they set it on fire in front of him and made it watch. I mean, they ripped out his intestines.
I didn't hear about the fire part. I did hear they emasculated and eviscerated him.
They burned it. And then they apparently, something else I learned from the extras is that they would chop off your head and then hurry up and turn it around toward your body, because they thought that you could still see for about 10 to 20 seconds, and they wanted you to see your headless body as like your last vision of the earth, and they did that to him too. And you know, we don't get any of that in this. It's the implication of the violence that is more gruesome. But also, yeah, lots of people get hit in the head with war hammers and diced up and sliced up, and there is blood everywhere for a lot of the movie. So it's pretty violent.
A lot of it, yeah. I mean, I am glad in the end that they went with the more tasteful route and not show him, you know, being emasculated and eviscerated and disemboweled and everything at the end. Like, that was a mercy, you know. He's supposed to be calling out for mercy, but he did us a mercy behind the director's chair, not showing us all that. I didn't need to see all that, because this is a very violent movie, and I'm happy that my 9-year old self didn't see that on top of all the war hammers to the faces and everything and the slit throats. I also remember a big part of this at 9 years old, seeing, you know, the marriage scene where Gibson and his wife Muron get naked in the woods. And I remember thinking it was like the most scandalous, like the most sizzling, hottest thing ever, you know, at 9 years old. But it was obviously much bigger in my head, no pun intended. We basically get a shot of her standing topless at night, and then they kiss and they embrace. And, you know, given the context of the movie and everything, it's a sensitive moment. It's well done. But, you know, in my head at 9 years old, it was like the raciest thing I could ever recall, because it was this beautiful topless woman on screen. I don't know. I mean, obviously not my first introduction to boobs, but early on for sure.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to assume that you saw barbed wire before this.
Oh, barbed wire and, you know, Kathy Ireland on the internet for sure.
Dare I speak the name of that film? Yeah.
dare you? dare you speak barbed wire in the presence of Braveheart.
I can't remember when I saw this all the way through for the first time. I think right when it came out, my mom and my sister went, and my sister bought the soundtrack. My sister's younger than me. She's right in between our ages. She's in 1984. She had the soundtrack to this, and I remember taking it and listening to it, and I'm like, damn, this soundtrack is amazing. I need to watch this movie. All these bagpipes are getting me in my feelings. And then I remember watching the big battle scene at my friend Aaron's house in like 10th grade before basketball practice. I remember getting the movie on DVD, and I remember watching Mel Gibson's commentary track for it, which I still remember pretty well. And I don't know, I guess maybe I watched it all the way through for the first time in college. All I can say is, regardless of any of that, watching it now, and obviously I watched it multiple times for this episode, there's a lot of subtext that went way over my head, even when I was in college, as far as like politics and class issues go that are in this movie that are pretty great. I'm maybe not as exciting as Catherine McCormick's boobs to a 9-year-old, but still pretty great.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely one of those movies as like a middle schooler, like you said, you would fast forward and watch the battle scene and, you know, watch the getting naked in the woods scene, of course, but especially the battle scene and the, you know, the big freedom speech that he gives. I mean, those are just, by now, that's just classic, like, cinematic moments, right? But, you know, as a young man, and I feel like this is a very man's movie, like a very dude movie. And
my wife said it was when she gave up on watching it after 5 minutes when I tried to get her to watch it with me.
She said, oh, this is a dude's movie.
Pretty much, yeah. Look, my mom requested this, and my mom is definitely not a dude. And I feel like my mom and I mean, she might not agree with this, but I feel like we kind of have like a shared desire for violent revenge somewhere in our hearts, because everyone who crosses Scotland or Mel Gibson or his friends in this movie dies, like, violently basically dies. And it's so sad. If you got the bloodlust, it's so satisfying. Every single one of them, man.
He kills a dude with like a deer antler. Like, come on.
Oh my gosh, I remember the like watching that scene for the first time when I was a teenager, and just, it was so satisfying. I remember like grunting, like when he shoved the deer horn through the guy's chin.
That is the testosterone in all young males, like as they watch this movie. Just, if you haven't had that experience, if, you know, that's what happens when you're a young man and you watch this movie. Because it's definitely, and I feel like it's kind of a movie that I've watched and then stayed away from a long time because of that associated in my head. Just because, like, you know, a bunch of dudes like in high school or college, like, yeah, dude, Braveheart, you know, it's the greatest movie ever, this battle's so awesome, you know. And I mean, if you don't know me by now from listening to this podcast, yes, I'm a dude, and I say dude a lot, and I say bra a lot, but I'm not like macho, you know. I'm never been into that whole deal. I'm not like a big sports guy or anything, but and, you know, we're here talking about the sensitive moment of him embracing his wife in the woods, you know, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I kind of stayed away from the movie for a while because of that, but revisiting it now, like you said, I saw a lot more than I remembered. You know, there's a lot of the subplots and the subtext here that I think are really valuable, really well done. So I'm excited to get into it.
Let's do that. Let's get into it.
Let's get into this movie.
I'm a dude, brah. I mean, I love sports. I played sports. I played football. I played basketball. I like on-screen violence. I'm not going to try to pretend like I don't.
I mean, I do too. I'm not saying I don't like that. Yeah, I mean,
you do like it. I feel like you're selling yourself short, and I'm going to tell a story about you really quickly from 2001. So,
all right,
that vibe that you're giving off, that you're saying about yourself. Okay, so you didn't play sports. You had kind of like that panda sloth vibe, right, back in the day.
The panda sloth vibe.
Yeah, you know, like, what would you say was your spirit animal then at that time?
Oh yes, yeah, so people called me sloth. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So I remember you and I were at like a house party show, and I was just goofing around. I was just gonna like throw you in a bush, like for fun. But I couldn't throw you in the bush. Like, you, like, matched me physically. Now, that was probably one of the weaker times in my life where I wasn't working out regularly. but still.
Like how you have to qualify it there. You're like, yeah, it wasn't working out, you know, yeah.
I was very surprised by your strength and tenacity, Jordan. So don't sell yourself short there.
I don't even remember this. You try to throw me in a bush.
No, that was when I knew that we would be friends for life, 21 years ago. I'd known you for a few years, but...
Friends for life. I can't throw this dude in a bush.
I can't throw him in a bush.
This guy's my friend.
That's right.
It's the true test of manhood. Can I throw you in a bush? Forget throwing stones at each other's faces.
That was it. That was our Hamish and William Wallace moment, Jordan. It was the bush.
Right.
I couldn't, just like Hamish couldn't hit Mel Gibson with the rock, I couldn't throw you in the bush. And that was it. I was like, well, I'm friends with this guy for life. I'll follow him to a podcast.
That was our moment that I don't even remember. Well, so speaking of these kid actors, you know, like we said, we got Hamish and William Wallace. Man, the kid actors in this in the beginning are pretty amazing, don't you think? Like, I didn't know if it was just Mel Gibson yelling obscenities at everyone off camera, but everyone in this is like super emotive and can cry like on the spot. Like, you need someone to shed a tear. He's just snapping his fingers and he's making even like giant old Brendan Gleeson cry like a baby, even though he's dressed up like a Scottish Viking. But yeah, I thought these kid actors were pretty amazing. I was really impressed. And I didn't remember any of the kid stuff from the beginning when he's a young boy.
Yeah, man. The girl that plays Murren, Catherine McCarmy's character, early in the film, where William Wallace's father gets killed fighting the British, and his brother does as well, and little Willie is too young to go fight with him. He's just a little boy. So he gets left behind, and then there's a funeral for his father and his brother, and he's there mourning, and he's kind of standing off on his own, and then Murren comes, and little four-year-old Murren comes and brings him a flower, and the actress was 4 years old, and Mel Gibson himself in the extras and in the commentary is like, I don't know how the hell she did that. Like, you know, when we turned the cameras off, she was just like a regular little four-year-old, like doing little cutesy four-year-old stuff, and then we rolled the cameras, and then it was like, oh my God, where's this coming from?
Right. She looks so distraught and concerned. Like, yeah, it's pretty amazing. And the little boy is just crying his eyes out, and he just looks, you know, so brokenhearted. But yeah, thought it was great.
And I feel like all these little moments of Wallace basically taking losses of things happening to him because of the damn British in this movie, Jordan. Evil British people.
That evil Brit.
This is just the start of that, the start of those insults to him and what's building up his desire for freedom and to get them the hell out of Scotland. But you know what comes? Who comes to see him to get him the hell out of there for all of the rest of his childhood up until the point that he is old enough to be Mel Gibson is Brian Cox, Jordan. Brian Cox just shows up on a horse and he's like, I'm your uncle boy. And then that's it. He's like, I'm going to teach you Latin and how to fight with a sword and how to use your wits. I like how my Scottish accent just devolved there and then not a Scottish
right,
accent.
Right. But just like Mel Gibson.
Yeah, that's right. What'd you think about Brian Cox riding up like that, man?
I thought he was awesome. I wanted to see more of his uncle in this, but you know, we just get a little bit early on. But yeah, the little bit that we do have, he's pretty amazing. He's got a great presence on screen.
Yeah, I like too how his dad said, it's our wits that make us men. And then his uncle is like stressing that to him. Like, you know, like our dad died just like your dad died. Like, you've got to learn how to use your brain before I'm going to teach you how to use a sword. And this is a very violent movie, and he does have to use violence, but he has to use his wits as the movie goes on, too. I kind of like that touch there, even if it's maybe just more lip service towards some intellectualism over violence. I mean, that's pretty cool, right?
Right, because he's, you know, he brings him off to Rome, and he teaches him all these languages, which, you know, I thought it was kind of humorous that anytime he wants to bed a woman, he's basically speaks to him like in French or some, you know, or in Latin to impress them. And then, you know, they immediately fall in love with him. So Mel Gibson is basically just like, yeah, I get to kill everybody. I'm a super badass. I get to have sex with all these beautiful women who love me. I know all these languages.
Well, it's two women, Jordan. Granted, it's two extremely beautiful women, Catherine McCormick and Sophie Marceau, but it is only two.
Yeah, well. For the movie, that's quite a bit. You gotta fit something in between all the battles, right?
Considering there are three women in total in this movie,
right?
Two thirds
exactly.
Of the women,
all the women in this movie, which is three,
and the third one is making a lot of eyes at him. So,
I remember talking to my wife about this movie and trying to get her to watch it with me, And she said, you know, she also saw this at a young age, and it was the scene early on where, you know, the bodies are hanging in the barn, like you said, and all his family are killed. And then later, you know, after we have this romance blossom between him and Murren, she's caught by the English and her throat is slit. And my wife, you know, she's like, I saw this at an early age and had nightmares about that scene, and just has kind of vowed like never to watch this movie again. So I'm one where if I see somebody like cut on screen, I literally like grabbed my neck when they sliced her throat. I will do that. Like if, you know, someone's getting shot on screen, no problem. I don't really react or feel it, but I guess the very like empath type personality I am, if I see anyone like cut with a knife, I'm going to wince. I'm going to grab my neck or wherever they're getting cut. And, you know, I don't really mind it like here and there. The arrows like to the guy's chest and all the head bashings don't bother me. But it's just something about somebody getting stabbed. It's just like the worst thing for me to watch. I can remember watching the movie. Have you ever seen The Hunted with Benicio Del Toro and Tommy Lee Jones?
I've never seen that.
It's basically like an hour and a half of them stabbing each other. So it was like, I remember seeing it in the theater and just like grabbing all over my body. Like, oh God, they're getting stabbed. That's terrible. It hurts. But yeah, so there's a good bit of that for me watching this.
We should watch the Evil Dead remake together, Jordan.
Yeah, we should. I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's really good.
Lots of stabbing in there.
Yeah. Man, speaking of stabbing, you know who really deserves to get stabbed in this movie is the English people as they're portrayed by the movie Braveheart. Because, man, they just make them so gross and so awful in this movie, oh, right? Man.
Especially that one dude who's like, basically he's the one that tries to rape his wife later on. But even when like the first nobleman comes to claim his right to the bride, you know, the prima nocte or whatever, you've got that like rat-faced guy who's like, like just like, you know, sniveling and just putting up this like nasty smile, like he's so delighted to see like this evil deed done. He just looks like the grossest human.
Well, later before he tries to assault Murren, the line that he says, "You remind me of my daughter back home." Like, how gross, man. Like, we already know they're gross. Like, we already know they're bad. Like, we don't need that.
Just make them more bad. Yeah. This movie is to everything to an extreme, you know, it had to go there.
Well, I understand why there was kind of an uproar in England about the way they were portrayed in this, because they're just nasty, man. Like, yeah. Every British person is awful.
I mean, going off of that, you know, it's been voted one of the most historically inaccurate movies. So, lots of people felt like it was anti-British when it came out and everything. But, you know, what's your take on the whole historical aspect here, or the inaccuracies?
Okay, so the prima noctem thing, I don't think that was occurring then.
Not in Britain.
No, yeah. Like that had occurred in history. Now, that's not to say that like bad things weren't happening, but that wasn't a policy that was instated there. Really, the thing that I think, well, I always give away my score way before we're supposed to do it. This could have been a 10 for me. And I think with some editing, it could be bumped up to a 10. I think the part of this film that was most criticized, just from like a, not a political level, just like on a decency level, is the homophobia with the storyline with the king's son, right? Where the king basically is this strong, he's an evil guy for sure, but he's always portraying like this real masculine like strength where it's like if you cross him, like you're going to die. And then his son in real life was a weaker king than him. And the whole issue with his wife there that he actually had children with and had like a heterosexual relationship with. And there's not really a historical consensus on if there was ever any homosexual behavior in his life at all. But that's really neither here nor there on whether that's historically accurate. He's just portrayed like it's like, oh, look at these guys. They're gay. What a bunch of weird guys. This guy is weak because he's gay. Like it's bad. Like it's not done well, and it's not necessary. It's really extraneous to the plot. All you really needed was to show that there's this really brutal king in England. His son doesn't hold the authority that he does. And really, that's not even important to the story. Really, his son doesn't really have much to do. I think they really thought, you know what, we've got female love interest for the first half of this movie, but she dies. We need one for the second. So we have this princess. Well, how can we get him to get together with this princess? Well, what if her husband is gay? Let us do that. Well, what if we throw in all this other stuff that's not necessary? Yeah. There are a lot of better ways the storytelling could have been there, where it's just like every time they cut from the stuff in Scotland, which is pretty much always like perfect to that, it's just like a record scratching. Like, and like everybody, like, what is this movie that we're in now? And it's a way... I don't want to say worse because the rest of the movie is pretty much perfect to me. It's like just a bad movie inserted into this really great movie. To me, that bothers me more than like any historical inaccuracies, because like the spirit of William Wallace, because he was a real person and we know it, he really did like the big major details, but the other stuff around him is really vague. Like no one knows for sure a lot of stuff about him. You know, a lot of stuff right. is based on a poem that was written about him later on as far as like our impression of him and what we know. So that stuff doesn't bother me. It's more just that the storyline back in England with the king's son, which is just really badly done and has no reason to be there, and really ends halfway through the movie where they're like, we don't need this anymore. Ditch it. Which is like, the way they ditch it is horrible, but...
Once his wife gets with Mel Gibson, you know, because he's just this scrawny, like sniveling little prince, and then she goes off to be with the real man, right? Who's just like this buff, big old, like barbarian dude who's gonna like really show her a good time. So I don't know, that was kind of like the, not the nail in the coffin really, because it didn't like kill the movie for me, but I was just like, oh, this reads really different in 2022. Oh man, yeah, that's... And I didn't quite feel like you, where it was like a record scratching anytime they cut away, but that stuff was problematic. It was there when they went back to England and the castle with the king and everything. But I mean, the guy playing King Edward the Longshanks, I thought he did an incredible job just being so evil and unlikable.
He just totally hams it up. Whenever he read the script for the movie, he told Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson's like, do you want to do this? And he said, yes, he's diabolical. And the way that he said diabolical, like, frightened Mel Gibson. Like, he was afraid. He was like, oh, man, I better let him be in this movie. And now I'm scared for my life.
Right, or he might shank me.
Yeah, that's right. No pun intended.
Or maybe it was. With the historical stuff, you know, I tend to side on the tell a good story aspect of things. So obviously they took a lot of cinematic liberties with the history here. But, you know, they admitted to it and said, hey, we took the spirit of William Wallace, like you said, and we went with it and we dramatized it and we tried to make it like the best like cinematic experience for you. So... you know, the little details here and there changed, like, oh, it really was, you know, Noble Monteith, not Robert the Bruce, who betrayed Wallace. Like, I don't care, like, if that's historically accurate or whatever, you know, because Robert the Bruce betraying Wallace totally works for the story. You know, it just keeps you on the thrill ride, and that's what this movie really is. And, you know, it's almost 3 hours long. And I, you know, looked at the runtime going in. And I was like, oh my God, why are we covering like another Titanic long movie? But it's amazing how fast it goes by and it sucks you in. And I didn't want it to stop. I just felt like they did a really great job telling the story. If it was completely accurate or not, they did what they set out to do, was just to tell this story with like this great, powerful message, and you know, recall a lot of the myth of Wallace at least, and present it to the masses. So what are you gonna do? You know, maybe they didn't wear kilts back then. Oh well.
You know who really doesn't care and loves this movie? People in Scotland, man. They ate this right. up, and they still do. I mean, this movie was received really well there. Hey, it's for them.
Yeah, right? I mean, because you can have a big-ass movie like this about your home country that, like, celebrates them in such a way. Like, yeah, you can forgive a lot, you know?
Yeah, dude, for real. Like you said, it's 3 hours long. So I did two very different viewings of this. I did a straight through viewing of it, but then I watched it for the second time in over 3 days in 1 hour increments. And it was really incredible just how well paced the movie is. And it's not it's not like episodic at all. It's just like really well paced and it flies by. There are a lot of 2 hour long movies I've seen recently that felt like they were twice as long as this.
Right. Cause I feel like the script is pretty amazing, and as far as the structure goes, it's a masterclass of, like, you know, first act, second act, third act, and your inciting event, and then, you know, like you're raising the stakes in the second act, and, you know, they're gaining victory after victory, and then they have like their big loss, you know, their lowest point in the third act, and then coming back from that and everything. It just flows so well, and it follows that whole like story structure paradigm like to a T, but it doesn't feel rote either. So it works. It's really well done.
Yeah, definitely, man. And I think something that's really important, and I'm assuming that we're not going to go like plot detail by plot detail through this, maybe just a loose framework, but something that I think really helps with what we're saying is that early on and really throughout the first hour or so of this movie, we get a lot of, I don't even want to call them minor characters. I'll call them like mid-major characters to care about, who just continuously pop up through the film in the battle sequences, who always have something to do, to where it gives the movie kind of a more lived-in feeling. You know, you've got Hamish, his best friend, played by Brendan Gleeson, his childhood friend. I mean, that guy's an incredible actor. And it's really funny seeing him in this with the crazy hair and the long beard, because he doesn't usually look like that. But, I mean, he's great. And, Jordan, I mean, spoiling the movie connection, the last movie that we actually talked about that was filmed and released in the 90s, The Matchmaker, starred David O'Hara as a heartthrob. He was good in The Matchmaker. He's in this, man. He's the crazy Irish guy. He was Stephen the Irish guy, who's his right-hand man, William Wallace's right-hand man. And then you've got, I'm forgetting the actor's name. He's the one that's in Sons of Anarchy. Do you know who I'm talking about?
I don't, but I just realized that was David O'Hara from The Matchmaker. I did not put that together, actually.
Jordan.
But yeah, I thought he was great. He looks completely different in this setting here. And I mean, I feel like he plays a better crazy Irish guy who's like kind of nutso in the head, you know, than he does as a heartthrob. But I mean, he's good. He's good in either role. But yeah, he really sold it as just this. You know, he comes on as just this madman, but he ends up being super loyal to Wallace. And yeah, like you said, he sticks with him and just continues throughout the film. And you're really, you know, endeared by him and Hamish and the whole crew by the end.
Right. It was Tommy Flanagan was the actor I was thinking of. He plays Morrison in this. And our introduction to him is early in the movie. He's getting married, and then the British nobles come for his wife, and, you know, he's about to get his throat slit trying to stop them. And there's a pretty powerful scene there. And it's like you have background on him, like instantly, like you're behind him. You're behind Hamish instantly. Hamish's dad, James Cosmo, who, man, in the extras, he in this movie, he's so gruff and like this big, enormous aging warrior. But he's like the softest, sweetest guy in the extras, man. I would have loved to hang out with him.
Yeah, I mean, he's the complete most badass person in this movie. He gets his hand chopped off, and then he's like right there in the next battle and gets like an axe to his chest, and he just like keeps going.
Right He's so good, and his relationship with Hamish is kind of explored to where you care about both of them, and you know they're there the whole time throughout the movie. They're always around. And then even his father-in-law, whose daughter died, and who there's a really a great scene where at the funeral where Wallace goes up to his father-in-law and just kneels down in front of him and humbles himself. And the father-in-law like kind of raises his fist and then just pats him on the head. He's in that last scene where they get the army together right before the credits for the final fight in Bannockburn, which is where the Scottish won their independence. He's there on the front line. Like, they brought him back to show like he's here for this cause. Like, that kind of continuity with the characters is another thing that makes this movie great.
I like how you're like, oh yeah, they really explore the relationships between Hamish and his dad. I'm like, yeah, that dude got his chest axed. He kept going. Maybe I am the macho bra.
You are, man. I'm telling you.
This movie's bringing it out.
It's bringing it out like a 2001 house party.
Well, we've talked about in the past watching movies where we know kind of like the actor or the director or the writer behind it. We had an issue with True Romance watching that movie and seeing Tarantino behind the scenes thinking like, oh, this is so cool. I'm so cool. Like, I, you know, this is a stand-in for myself. And at one point, Wallace comes in after they've killed his wife. He's just badass. Like we said, he kills this dude with the antler horns and he's just taking all the Englishmen out. And this is like the first, you know, moment where I start thinking or possibly having issues where I'm thinking to myself, is the director here or the actor here like imagining themselves as this badass? Are they ego tripping? Like, is Gibson casting himself in this role like, oh yeah, man, I get to kill all these people, have sex with these beautiful ladies, I'm basically like a god. But no, it does help me a little bit to know that he actually thought he was too old for the part. And as we'll probably discuss as another movie connection, he wanted to cast a younger man. He wasn't like, oh, I'm in the, you know, I'm not doing this movie unless I'm the star and I get to behead 800 dudes. He was like, oh, yeah, you want me to be Wallace? No, I'm like 40 and he's supposed to be 20. Oh, a big pile of money? Okay, I'll direct it. And I get to behead 800 dudes.
Jordan, I'm glad you brought that up because that is something I want to talk about too. Something about Mel Gibson on, again, on a professional level. I'm not talking about Mel Gibson outside of a Hollywood set. I'm talking about professional right. Mel Gibson as a director. I feel like he has a lot of humility, and that's something in the extras for all his movies. You find all the cast members saying because of his experience as an actor, he's very deferential to all the other actors and what they might want to do or what their instincts are. And I like in this movie how much he kind of backs up and gets out of the way. Because in all the scenes that I was talking about with the other characters, right? Really his squad, so to speak, in our horrible 2022 parlance. Whenever they have a moment, he backs up. He's like out of the frame. And they're having their moment. Like the situation with Hamish and his dad. Like he doesn't sort that out and help them find peace with one another. Like they do that on their own. Or yeah. Like the Tommy Flanagan character, he's not there to do anything about the situation with his wife early on. You know, whenever Tommy Flanagan gets killed, he can't save him. If you really look at screen time in this movie, he's in this less than you would think he is. And his character gets humbled and humiliated a lot. I mean, he gets executed at the end of the movie, but he gets humbled a lot in this film. So as much as he has this big grandstanding moments, and there's one I can't wait to talk about in a couple of minutes, it's kind of a humble portrayal in certain ways, not in every way, right? I mean, you already talked about the women, but in a lot of other ways, he is very
humble in every way but the women.
That's right. They want me. Actually, you know, Hamish was getting some looks from the queen's aide, like some major looks, man. If they could have just had some more time together, he could have had some little French babies later.
That's
on
a whole nother deleted scene right there.
That's right.
But I agree. I do think that there's a lot of screen time that he gives to other characters. There's a lot of character moments. And I was surprised to see it cut away so much to, you know, for one example, Robert the Bruce and his father and, you know, that whole relationship and the power dynamics explored there. So that was really interesting. And again, a lot of movies, you might have a lot of characters and you get lost or there's just too many subplots going on. But I felt like it was all really well balanced here and it worked. So, yeah, good job. Good job on Gibson's part. Yeah, knowing that a little bit, that he wasn't just like, yeah, I'm the one for this, you know, but he did think about casting somebody younger and they pushed for him since, you know, he's a big movie star and he's going to bring in all the money. I felt like he was great for the role, too. I didn't feel like he was too old or it was too distracting or anything.
Right. And if you look at all the films he's directed, he's done 5. He did one before this, The Man Without a Face, where he's probably most prominently featured in besides this. And then he does Passion after this, which he's not in other than an insert shot of his hand hammering in a nail. And then he's not in Apocalypto. He's not in Hacksaw Ridge, which to date is the last film that he did. So
yeah.
I don't think that he had any interest in like making himself look awesome by doing this movie.
Right. Well, I'm glad we settled that.
Yeah, it's settled. We said it and that's the truth. Dadgum. Hey, Jordan. So I know we're not going through every plot point, but I do feel like whenever the Scottish finally meet the British on a major field of battle, we've got to talk about the Battle of Stirling, because that sequence to me is like a signature 90s movie sequence and probably one of the best like major scenes in a 90s movie. What do you think, Jordan?
I would agree. I mean, my next note is the Battle of Stirling, because this is a total dude movie and we're going to only talk about the battles, right? I mean, it's hard to deny the power of that one scene. You know, even though they have the spears, we know they're going to make the spears out of the trees when they're hanging out in the forest and he gets the idea. We don't actually see the spears until the very last second as the armored horses are barreling down on them. I mean, my heart was pounding, my blood was pumping. They've got the Blue Man Group makeup on. He gives the freedom speech. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, we could just talk about the speech itself, because I mean, that is quintessential 90s, like top 10 speeches in a movie right there, other than the Fat Man speech I mentioned earlier.
Right.
I mean,
fight and you may die. Run and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your beds many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
They'll never take our lives. They'll never take our freedom.
That's for 90 speeches, it's up there with Today We Declare Independence Day by Bill Pullman in Independence Day. It's great, but man, the thing I didn't notice watching it when I was younger is kind of the politics and the classism around these battles. Because what happens is you have these Scottish lords, and every time the people are getting ticked off and they're like, we're going to rise up, the lords are like, yeah, let's do it. Let's meet them in a field of battle. And then the lords ride out. And the English are like, hey, instead of fighting us, what if we just give you all the land that your peasants are on and you can be in charge of them? And that'll be that. And they're like, oh, that sounds great. Good idea. Then they go back to the peasants and say, hey, good news. We're not going to fight. And I own all your land now, which is something that completely went over my head up until really these viewings. So everyone's on the battlefield and they're like, great, it's happening again. Like these two douchebag nobles are going to just get more land. They're going to get our land. And then we're going to go home and nothing's going to change. And then, man, you get James Horner's incredible score as Mel Gibson rides up. Like you hear it, the music rides up and then you see him ride in with his crew. And it's like, I think Mel Gibson's about to give a badass speech. And we are going to have a fight here.
Right. Because, yeah, it makes him even more of a hero that, unlike these noblemen, he's not going to compromise. He's not just going to give in and take whatever bribe they have to offer. He's just like, hell no. Like, I want my freedom, not your freaking money. You know, like, it's about, you know, something bigger than that. So, yeah, I really appreciated the, I guess, the morals and the message of this movie. In that, you know, they're going to stand up to tyranny, they're going to stand against evil and like fight for what they believe in, and like, yeah, not take any bribes, like not going to take this facing down. So, I mean, like I said, it's hard to deny the power of that scene. It's hard to deny the power of this movie just in general, because, yeah, I have to say I was roused. I was inspired. Give me that freedom speech 10 more times. Give me my freedom fries and my freedom speech.
That's a deep cut callback inside joke right there. And I love it. I love it, man. And I'm with you. Like, this speech has stood the test of time. People still quote it now. I mean, there's a reason even that it's been parodied so much, because when something has that kind of power, sometimes the only reaction is to nervously make fun of it because you know how great it is.
Because you can't handle the power.
That's right. And then, man, the tension as the two armies are running toward each other. And, of course, you have the mooning scene where they moon the British before the fight. And I love how then the British shoot arrows and there's the cutaway shot of the guy getting shot in the butt.
Shot in the butt, yeah. That's, like, forever seared in my brain. It's freedom speech, boobs in forest, and arrow in butt. That's basically the images from this movie that have stood the test of time.
But man, after that, the armies charge at each other, and you just get this tense drone from James Horner that just keeps building and just rising. The pitch keeps rising and rising as the armies are running toward each other, and you keep cutting back and forth as they're getting closer and closer. And then it's just bodies hitting into each other, and then it's chaos, but at the same time, you can tell what's going on. You get plenty of shots of all the characters we've been introduced to fighting and just kicking ass. It's such a great scene. But Jordan, for me, my favorite part of this movie, the best part of this movie to me, is that they've shown all these characters get so beaten down over the past hour and a half of the movie, and just how much they've been under the English's feet, that when they start winning the battle, and then it's clear they're gonna win, and Mel Gibson is just covered in blood, and his men are exhausted, and they're just slaughtering the last few British troops that are alive. And then he turns around, and the music starts building and building. And then he lifts his sword in the air as the last British are killed. And everyone looks around like, holy shit, we just won. Like, we just beat these guys. And then he screams, Jordan. He screams, yeah, so loud and so awesomely with the music behind him. And a lot of movies where they didn't get like, hey, this is really important and this is a huge cathartic moment, would cut away there. But they don't, Jordan. The music swells even louder. And then the bagpipe comes in because it's just strings. And then the bagpipe comes in too. And then he yells, yeah, again. And you get shots of all the guys that we know in this army that we've been introduced to screaming yeah to, and it's just so cathartic and badass. And then he just slams his sword into the ground and walks away, and then we just get a shot of the sword kind of waving in the grass after he slammed it in. And that 30 seconds, really, it's probably closer to a minute, that's one of my favorite moments in a 90s film, man. It's so powerful.
Don't you think they were celebrating the violence there a little bit too much, though, Nick?
Hell no, man. I wish that they could have killed even more of them.
More English need to die.
And again, my mom might not agree, but I think we have that same thing in both of us. When we see righteous slaughter, we get really, really excited about it.
Righteous vindication.
That's right. Well, maybe we're not as fully evolved as other humans, but I just really, really enjoy seeing that. I'm not going to lie. Maybe that makes me less of a human.
No, I mean, it's a great scene. Again, it's hard not to get behind it. But I really like later on, you know, we talk about the different battles. And sometimes in a movie, you get battle after battle and it just kind of drones on and you might get a little tired of it. I like later when they face off against the English again. And they're outnumbered, and you know the Irish have been conscripted. They're charging toward each other, and then all of a sudden, for me, I'm thinking, we've seen this already. It has the similar kind of editing where they're like running back and forth at each other, and then they change it up. The Irish are secretly in league with them, so they stop right in front of each other and start shaking hands. I love that, just different little clever things in this movie to kind of change it up, to break up the pacing, to keep you, on your toes, not expecting the next thing. And that goes with all the little clever, battle tactics they have, where they've poured like the tar on the ground and they shoot the flaming arrows or the English, where they anticipated the English to be standing. I'm just a sucker for all those little clever things, Of course, it's got to be by the hero. If it's King Longshanks, then I'm not for it, because he's got his own little device. That dude sucks, yeah. Exactly. You're not clever. You just suck. You're just evil, dude.
And it's here at this point where we find that the Scottish nobles have betrayed William Wallace, and instead of helping him to fight as they did in the last battle, where they kind of ride in after it's already over, basically, and they're like, yeah, and they look so dumb, man. Then I love how they just make the nobles in this movie look so annoying. Maybe that's just me.
Yeah, they do.
They look really annoying. They ditch Wallace and leave him and his men to die, and then you get the really evil moment from Patrick McGough and his Longshanks, where he orders his archers to fire arrows while his men, his infantry, are fighting against the Scottish already. And, you get someone saying, like, won't we hurt our own guys? And he's like, yes.
Yes, but we have reserves. Like, oh, well.
He hands the evil up so often. I mean, so awesomely.
He's so evil.
But he's got a masked man next to him,
Ah, yes.
And we don't know who that is yet, but I feel like you want to talk about Magooan, so I'll save that for your Magooan talk.
Okay, you go for that after this, because, yeah, Magooan, again, well, first of all, what a great name, Magooan. But speaking of names, King Edward the Longshanks, and this is just totally off topic, but anytime I hear the word or the phrase the Longshanks, I have to think of my friend Trevin. Nobody listening to this, maybe, but a couple know who Trevin is, but he's a good friend of ours back home here in Louisiana, and he's moved away now, but went to college with Trevin, you know, and Trevin's an unusual name, but one memory I have is a mutual friend of ours, Matthew, not having seen Trevin in a long time, probably forgot his name. He sees him at some event and he walks up to him and he says, "Hey man, hey, you're what's your name again? Oh yeah, Trampus. Trampus." And we're just like, what the hell? Trampus? Like, what is Trampus? Like, who names their kid Trampus? But somehow Trampus, you know, which was such an absurd name, we just started calling him Trampus all the time, just to rag on him, right? But Trampus, I don't know if it was from that to something else or Longshanks came in later, but at some point we just started calling him Trampus the Longshanks, and that was just what I referred to him as for a long time, until he was like, hey man, can you stop calling me Trampus the Longshanks? I was like, all right dude, all right. So yes, that's what I think of when I see evil Magooan as King Edward the Longshanks.
Now I have that imagery in my head as well. That's great. I had no idea what you were going to say there, and you genuinely surprised me.
I'm glad to be of service.
Speaking of surprises, so this guy with the helmet on, that we don't know who he is, he's just this knight next to Magooan. Well, after Magooan decides he's had enough of the battle, he's won, he's going to ride off with his knights, you hear some other people say to this guy that with the helmet on to protect his king. So he rides out to fight Wallace, who is his charging at the king on his horse, and knocks Wallace off his horse. And then they have a little scrum on the ground, and Wallace pulls off the helmet. And who is it but Robert the Bruce himself, who Wallace had placed so much faith in. They have a talk before this battle where he's asking him to join him, and he's like, "I can see in you like who you are." You know, he really sees that this guy wants Scottish independence and he's really a good man. But here he's placed his faith in him and now he's been betrayed. And dude, the performances from Gibson and Angus McFadden, or Fadyen, I'm not sure how to say his name. You know, we can't pronounce anyone's name. But dude, their eyes in this scene, he just breaks William Wallace's spirit. And it's discussed later on, but it's just like he can't even get up after this. Like, he just lays on the ground and he has to get rescued by old David O'Hara on a horse. But man, Angus McFadyen, after this, he has a scene with his dad where he's talking to him because his dad has leprosy, right? And he lives in a tower and no one knows what's happened to him. And man, he has like the most 90s quote too, where he's talking about how he saw something in William Wallace, like his belief, and he felt like he took it away from him, and like his heart is broken, and his dad is basically like, that's fine, you know, like you're going to be King of Scotland because of all this backstabbing and wheeling and dealing with the British. It's okay. You know, you don't have to believe. And then he's like, I want to believe, right? Like, it's like X-Files. I was like, man, this is the 90s. It's so good. Yes. But his eyes are just so emotional in that scene, man. It's just a great performance.
Yeah, I think overall he was a great performer. I mean, there's a couple of lines, I think, where he was trying to go big and emotional that I felt like he didn't quite reach it. As far as like on the same level as Gibson does in places. But overall, yeah, I thought he was a great performer. And especially in that scene where Gibson discovers that he's been betrayed, like you said, just in their eyes, they don't have to say a word. It's just like this brokenhearted, like, you know, he's just lost his faith, you know, like, oh, he would have never expected this guy to be under the helmet, which I didn't see it coming either. I'd totally forgotten this part, but it was a surprise to me too, because at first I was like, who's the dude in the helmet? Like, did he bring his son to the battle and he's like decked out in armor so that he won't get hurt or whatever? But then like, oh no, okay, this is like, you know, Dark Knight, like Monty Python. Like, this, you know, reminded me of Monty Python the Holy Grail with the Dark Knight with that same kind of helmet on with a lance, and he's like, all right, none shall pass or whatever. So he's like guarding Wallace from going after the king. a lot more serious moment here than Monty Python. I don't know why my mind jumped there other than the armor.
Because it was a great misdirect. I mean, knights with helmets on. I hear you.
For sure.
Hey, but
for
something sure. that's historically accurate here is that...
something historically accurate.
And again, the broad strokes here are accurate. All the battles were fought. The battles that are won in the film were won. The ones that are lost were lost. And they did lose this battle. But he did escape with his life, Wallace did. And then he did carry out other actions. And then basically the next like 25 minutes or so was just like total, so satisfying revenge where he just kills all the guys that betrayed him except for Robert the Bruce, because he still thinks he's the future of Scotland. But there's a part where the most annoying looking guy out of all the nobles, he goes to his house and the guy is already having nightmares about him, because we get some dream sequences in this movie.
They're pretty gnarly.
He dreams that Wallace is coming for him, then wakes up and Wallace is there in his bed on a horse holding a giant mace and just slams it down into his face, and they show and his head gets crushed. And I loved it. I said yes.
It's pretty gruesome, but it was pretty satisfying. But then, you know, he's being chased by, I guess, whoever's like within the quarters he's inside of, and he jumps out of the window on a horse down into the water below, which I just thought, you know, poor horse, when they show him swimming away, but the horse is just like floating sideways, obviously dead in this water, which brings up this whole horse controversy. I'm guessing you read about this where...
Jordan, I watched 17 hours of Extras. I know all about this.
You know all about the horse stuff. You know more than me, obviously, but he was investigated. Gibson was, because they felt like, you know, these animal cruelty groups felt like there obviously had been some sort of mistreatment of these horses. And you know, they couldn't believe these were fake horses being used in these scenes. But they actually built these mechanical horses to do these battle scenes, and obviously for the dead horse scene in that moment. On top of that, Gibson challenged anybody to see if they could notice the fake horses in the film. I don't know if that's what brought on his investigation by the animal cruelty groups, but yeah, I did not see in my one watching of it any shot that I could say, hey, that was fake, other than, you know, maybe when the horse is floating sideways in the river that he jumps into, or the moat. It was a moat.
Yeah. So in the extras, you see how they use the real horses and then transition to the fake ones for the shots where violence is happening to the horses. And he says, you know, I'm kind of surprised no one took me up on that, because you can definitely tell, and I don't think you can in the moment, but when he jumps out that window, the horse's legs aren't moving. And to him, he always thought someone would call him out on that, which didn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's just everything's happening so fast. You're caught up in the moment and the drama of the story that, to me, that doesn't really bother me. I mean, you go with any movie, you're going to have goofs or like inaccuracies or continuity issues or whatever. Like if you go on the IMDb for this movie, it's like a mile long of all the different goofs or the different things that didn't work or, you know, were off or whatever. But to me, that's like, that's nitpicky stuff that in the moment, unless it's like egregious and really just poorly done and, you know, badly made movies, I'm not going to notice that. I don't care to like nitpick and look at that kind of stuff with a fine tooth comb or anything, because like I don't care reading through all that stuff like, there was blood on his neck one moment and then like the blood splatter was slightly different in the next shot or whatever. Like, who cares? Like, I'm caught up in the story, man.
I'm with you, man. I could give a shit. I'm with you. I don't care about that stuff either. It has to be like extremely blatant. Where it's like Mel Gibson himself is wearing a wristwatch that there's a close-up of, right? Like, otherwise, I don't care, man. Movies are miracles, man. It's a miracle that thousands of people or hundreds of people can work together ecumenically to make a product like this, a work of art like this. So if there are some goofs in there, who gives a shit, man? People that point that stuff out, I mean, that's cool. If that's what you're into, hey, good for you. Good for you. But I could care less about that stuff.
Right. I had one nitpick toward the end as far as storytelling choices go. And I don't know, this might have been because I broke up my viewing into two parts and that could have like screwed up the pace for me, or is like just, you know, still being caught up in the moment. I watched like the last 30 minutes of this the next day. And so, you know, we end with him being captured, as we discussed. They want him to pledge allegiance to the king, but he won't. He's going to stick to, you know, his morals and to, like, you know, what he believes in. So, of course, they're going to torture him. They're going to behead him. And I totally didn't remember that he died in this. I was thinking, you know, this is, you know, obviously we have... Again, I haven't seen it since I was young. So I was like, the whole ending had escaped me. And I was thinking, oh, is this going to be some like Robin Hood stuff for a minute where his band of merry Scots bust him out of like the guillotine at the very last second or something?
Because they're there in the crowd, the ones that are still alive, Hamish and David O'Hare's character.
Yeah, they're just hanging out. So, you know, you see so many movies like that. Oh, I mean, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where we're watching, he's about to be hung or whatever. And or somebody's about to be hung and they shoot him down off the gallows or whatever. So I had all that in my head thinking like, oh yeah, how is he going to bust out of here? Like, oh, I don't know how they're going to get out of this. But obviously he's not, because, you know, that would have been a little too historically inaccurate, I guess. So like, oh yeah, he lived, he escaped, he went on to conquer Scotland or whatever. In the end, his death inspires Robert the Bruce. And we talked about, you know, them not showing the evisceration, everything. But I mean, it is a pretty gnarly and touching scene where they want him to cry mercy and he cries freedom. And then he sees the ghost of his wife in the crowd and he smiles, and then they behead him. Well, obviously the impact of that death did not have the effect the English were looking for, because it inspires Robert the Bruce in the end to finally stand up and take action. He's out on the battlefield. You know, he's about to, this is, I guess, years later, down the line, he's going to, in the ceremony, to accept like his kingship of Scotland and pledge allegiance to the English and everything. But he finally decides, no, I'm going to take action. And it might be that in this scene, it's just that the guy playing Robert the Bruce, what was his name again? McFadden?
Angus.
Angus, yeah. All right, good old Angus. Let's just call him Angus, because, you know, more 90s. It might just be that the guy playing Robert the Bruce here, Angus, is looking super awkward in his chainmail helmet, because he's got like this great head of hair. He's a good looking guy. He looks very cinematic earlier on when he's like in his furs and, you know, he looks very kingly and stuff, but he's up on the horse. He just looks completely lame to me. He's just like the opposite of William Wallace. I would not follow this dude into battle. He just looks kind of like he's about to pee his pants or something.
Skip the climax of the film to get straight to that. So right. I hear you. I know what you're saying, but I think he was purposely awkward at the start of that because he still has not decided to be a Braveheart. He's still thinking like, man, maybe I will just like do what's political to make sure I keep my kingship, because the nobles with him and the men out there with him aren't sure of what he's going to do in this moment, if he's just going to kowtow to the British again and sell all his countrymen out.
Right.
So I think he's struggling with that. And I think that's why
it
looks
like,
I think that's why it looks like he's taking a dump on his horse. Right. Because that's really what it looks like. But
he does. That horse is totally getting poo-pooed on. But
but I love that you skip the execution scene to get straight to that. The horse getting pooped on.
Right.
That's amazing. We're Film Shake, everyone, just in case you tuned in late.
Yeah, William Wallace gets executed, yada, yada, yada. Oh, yeah, but Robert the Bruce takes a dump on his horse.
Yeah, well, man, I really enjoyed how hard to say that you enjoy the scene of him being executed, but there's a lot of thoughtfulness. Really, you get the POV view. He's let out in the crowd and they're throwing garbage at him and yelling at him. And the music is really stirring and emotional. And I like how before that he has a chance
where Sophie Marceau gives him a drug that'll dull his pain, and he doesn't want to hurt her, so he drinks it, but as soon as she walks out of the room, he spits it out. He wants his wits about him, because he wants to make sure that he doesn't break down or crack or not say what he has planned to say.
Which is freedom.
It's freedom, that's
just
right.
Just one word, man. You can remember just one word. Take the drug. No, I'm joking.
Right, and he's being tortured so badly that, you know, Hamish and David O'Hare are both saying, like, mercy, like, please. And even the crowd has had enough and is crying out for mercy for him. And I liked how he has the fight with Hamish before this, where Hamish is like, you're just doing this for Murren. And he's like, well, no, but, you know, she is looking down on me and seeing what I'm doing. She believes in what I'm doing. And your dad is looking down on you, too. And because his father died in the battle that they lost, which right. is a moving scene. And then Hamish just punches him in the face. Like, how dare right. you even talk about my dad? And they kind of have like a slight falling out there. But Hamish is there in the crowd. And then, sure enough, maybe it's just in his head, but Murren was looking down because her ghost comes through the crowd in his last moments and they make eye contact. And it's just like a really little beautiful thing, you know, and the score is rising.
And then head chop.
Well, before the head gets chopped, you know, he kind of like mutters, and then the executioner, which again, and look, here's the thing too, right? Like, they, as bad as they make British people look, they really went to town on this guy's body both before and after he was dead. If you really want to, like, get people to not fight you anymore, it would have been if they could have just killed him and thrown him in a dumpster and it been over. But to do all this stuff to him, and to, they don't show this, but they do mention that his body parts basically get shipped to all the corners of England and put on stakes for people to see. Like, you're just going to make people want to fight you more. Like, right, that, like, that's not a great idea.
How is that going to help?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I guess to scare people into submission, I guess, but...
Yeah, but then you get them thinking he's going to cry out for mercy, and like you said, he doesn't. He yells, freedom, the music swells, it's a big tearjerker moment, that bagpipe comes in, he sees Murren again, and then the axe comes down, and he drops the thing that he's holding, which I don't know what that thing was. I feel like a bad viewer, and all the times I've watched this, it's something that gets passed between him and
some
Robert
DeBruce.
Some
sort of cross-stitched like cloth that she had made for him.
Right.
Looked like
right.
he had some stitching that she'd done. Yeah, it was like a napkin or something.
Yeah.
He's got this dirty, bloody napkin throughout the whole movie. And then I like how it's almost like a metaphor for his head being chopped off. He drops the napkin and it's just fallen towards the ground, like his head's fallen into the basket.
Right, yes. They don't have to show that.
They don't have to show the head. Just show the dirty napkin. Toilet paper rag that he's been carrying around.
Right.
Just to desecrate your sensitive moment, Nick. Already wanted to skip over, yeah.
By saying that Robert the Bruce was taking a dump on his horse in the next scene,
yeah.
Which is the final scene of the movie.
He desecrated it, not me. Come on.
Well, then he stops making the constipated face and is like, we're going to fight. We're going to kick these British people's asses. And then, really, I remember my biggest disappointment with this movie, watching it as a teenager, was I wanted to see them kill all the British in this scene.
Yeah, yeah.
But instead, Hamish is like, we're going to fight, and he's really pumped. And you get cuts to all everyone who survived. Really, every person who's been in this movie up to this point that is able to fight is shown, and then Hamish yells and he throws the sword through the air and then it sticks in the ground, and that's our last shot. It looks really badass. And then, you know, we find out that historically and now Mel Gibson is doing the voiceover, because there was a voiceover before at light moments, and it's Robert the Bruce talking about the legend of William Wallace.
That was really my biggest nitpick about this movie and the storytelling choices, like I was going to go for earlier, but the voiceover, and I'm not a big fan of voiceover, but, you know, I'm fine with it starting with Robert the Bruce and ending with Robert the Bruce, but then all of a sudden you've got Mel Gibson sticking in the last, like, historical word, you know, which just seemed really weird. Like, and it doesn't even sound like he's doing the William Wallace voice. It's just Mel Gibson, the director, telling you what happened, you know, in history where the Scottish won their independence and everything. I think it, I don't know, it's just a little nitpick, but it might have been better to have that as, like, text on the screen or something.
I get you. That's a tough spot, too, right? Because this whole time, Robert the Bruce has been talking about William Wallace. So it would be weird if he was talking about himself, but by the same token...
And then we won our independence. Yeah, that would have been weird, too.
William Wallace is dead now. The way that I excuse this moment in my mind, because I mean, I agree with you, and if people have listened to all these episodes, I'm sure I've mentioned two or three times I'm not the biggest fan of voiceover unless it's highly justified. Yeah, either by the film or by me in my own head. But I just thought, since we've kind of had these spectral presences up to this point, this is like his spirit is saying this to you, Jordan. His eternal spirit, which will never die.
I guess in the spirit world, he doesn't need his Scottish accent anymore.
Look, watch it again. Watch it again, because, you know, I've watched it like 1,000 times. You're right in that he doesn't really talk in the Wallace voice, but it's still in a Scottish accent. So I don't know. He does still use a Scottish accent. It's just different.
It's just his spirit voice.
Yeah. It's his spirit voice. That's right. That's right. Well, that's Braveheart, Jordan.
He said, on one hand, I wanted to see more English people die, and, you know, but I didn't want quite another battle either, because I just felt like that would have been too much. So I didn't really know what to do with my feelings there. I was kind of bummed that it cut off and it was just the voiceover telling us the outcome. Like, I really, really kind of hate it when movies do that and they just like kind of explain the rest of the story, like in text or in voiceover, but I don't know. I don't know what to do with the ending there. But like you said, it could have been like just total 10 out of 10, 5 out of 5 for me. But there's a few little choices like that that threw me off.
I hear you. I hear what you're saying. I think different things in this movie knocked it off of the perfect pedestal for us. For me, the ending, I do feel like all of the character stories came to a satisfying conclusion. Obviously, Wallace is dead, but Robert the Bruce really does have his own storyline again, where Mel Gibson is not involved in a lot of it. It's mostly between him and his dad, where he's finally got to like throw up the shackles of like just giving in to what the nobles have always done at this point. And that movie, since he really is the one who defeats England in the end and gets the Scottish independence, he's the one who finishes it, even if William Wallace started it. So really, he's been on a journey this whole time, too, as have all the other characters. So I really felt like watching it being older, and I think probably by college, I was at this point, you know, we've already had the perfect amount of battles. More battles are going to be kind of extraneous and a little too much. This moment where he decides to finally fight and not give in anymore, to me, like narratively, I feel like that brings things to completion. So I don't really have a problem with how it ends.
That's a good point. I mean, I do appreciate his story throughout and how it's resolved there, where, you know, finally he stands up and makes the right choice, and just all the stuff about every man dies, but not every man really lives. Like, that stuff gets to me, man. Like, I don't know. I don't know who you are or where you come from, but just those like little nuggets of wisdom. And, you know, some people might say, hey, that's kind of cliche or overdone or whatever, but watch this freaking movie with the James Horner score behind that kind of stuff, you know, and it just kills me. It's just like, yeah, let's go battle. let's go live it up, man.
Dude,
throw me in a bush or something.
Throw me in a bush. Then I'll know if we're meant to be lifelong friends.
Right.
If I can't throw you in the bush.
That's right.
Yeah, man, that James Horner score, man, it never gets old. James Horner, for me, one of the biggest composers of the 90s, with John Williams, with Danny Elfman, and just a couple of others, man, because he did Patriot Games, which we talked about earlier.
I mean,
he did Clear and Present Danger, is awesome. But I think he should have won the Oscar for this. I've talked about the Oscars before. I have some things about the Oscars to say later, but he lost to the guy that composed Il Postino, you know, the postman. And here's how much research I do for this show. I thought, you know, that's ridiculous. He should have won best score. I'm going to listen to this Il Postino and it's going to be trite and stupid. And, you know, I listened to it and it's pretty good, Jordan. That's Il Postino. Good. I've never seen that movie. It's got a good score. I still think James Horner's score is better. I mean, there's just like a wheelbarrow full of themes in this movie, and they're all great and highly memorable and perfectly timed in the film. But I just want to say James Horner's great. I wish he was still alive. I wish he could still compose music for films. He's amazing.
Yeah, he's pretty great. Good job, James. Have you seen the spinoff of Braveheart, the newish Robert the Bruce film with the same actor who played Robert the Bruce?
I didn't know that existed until earlier today when I was doing a little extra research for this episode. So I've not seen it. Have you?
No, I haven't. I'm like you. I'd heard of it and that it had come out. I'd heard the title, Robert the Bruce, and maybe a couple people say it like wasn't that great, but I didn't realize it was the same actor playing the same role, you know, just what, like 20 years later. So that's pretty cool. That was from 2019.
Pretty crazy. Well, look, I gave my score 9 out of 10 already. Where are you on this?
I'm at a solid 4 out of 5. And despite any of the little issues that I had with it overall, like, it's just a really rousing, like, enjoyable watch. Like I said, the 3 hours just really flew by and I could have had more of it. So anytime a movie this long can do that, and it's just such a satisfying experience, I've got to go at least 4, maybe 4.5 if I'm really being generous. But yeah, it's a great movie. It's hard to deny.
It's so good. It's so good.
And I watched it on the Blu-ray and it looks amazing. I was surprised at just like how crisp and clean and like awesome looking this looked on the Blu-ray. So I definitely recommend that to anybody wanting to go out and rewatch it.
Yeah, great looking movie. Well, I told you a movie connection already. David O'Hara is in this, and he's in The Matchmaker. He's great in both movies. He's such a wacky guy. I'd say I wish we'd seen more of him, but you know what? He works steady. He just did a lot of it in the British Isles. So that's my movie connection, is David O'Hara. Do you have one yourself?
Speaking of people that we wanted to see more of, you know, on our previous episode that we recorded for the 80s podcast, Good Times, Great Movies, we talked about Solar Babies. And we talked about Jason Patrick and how we wanted to see more of him in the 80s and the 90s. Didn't quite get to see him, you know, as much of a star as we thought he would become, you know, especially after doing The Lost Boys. But apparently Mel Gibson had considered Jason Patrick for the William Wallace role. Like I said, Gibson thought he was too old for the part. And I think Jason Patrick would have been a really cool fit here. Like, obviously, Gibson brings something to the table that I think is pretty perfect. And we wouldn't want to change now. But I don't know. This could have been like a career, you know, igniter for Jason Patrick. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe, you know, gonna have seen some more of that weird chest hair in those Naked in the Woods scenes. Like, there's a lot of possibilities.
Man, his hair would have been flowing so wildly.
Yeah. He wouldn't need to wear no wig.
Yeah, what could have been, man? What could have been? You know, Mel Gibson did fine, though. He did great.
Yeah, I'd say he did more than fine. I think he's probably the right choice in the end, just for the charisma that he brings to the role. And I mean, I don't know if Jason Patrick can yell freedom like that, because that's pretty much like the core prerequisite of this movie. Like, can you growl and yell freedom and look like a badass? Then okay, yeah, you're Mel Gibson, you have the part.
Oh, you're Mel Gibson, all right.
Oh yeah, you're Mel Gibson, all right.
Hey Jordan, are you ready for the trivia battle?
Hold it. Pop quiz, hot shot.
I am ready. Speaking of history, I'm ready for this trivia battle.
I will say, you know how much I hate the Oscars. I hate awards. I watched the Grammys with my wife because she begged us to, and I played Doom Eternal on my Switch the whole time. But, you know, there were some pretty cool musical performances there. But I haven't watched the Oscars in a while. I'm not a big fan. I know a lot of people are. It's just not for me. It gives me a weird vibe. And all my questions are based on the 68th Academy Awards from nice. March of 1996, which Braveheart won Best Picture in, and several other awards. So I'm being a jerk in a way, because I hate the Oscars. But here are all my Oscar-based questions.
Now, does this fulfill the requirement of questions you know the answer to, even though you're not an Oscar fan?
I knew all the answers to this. I did still watch the Oscars at this time, and I watched this very Oscar broadcast. There is one question, though, and it's my fourth question, if I ask these in order, that I did not know the exact answer to, but it was too great a question not to ask. I had to ask it. It's an amazing question. The other ones, I knew the answers to.
That's fine. Well, for my run of things, I went with, again, the Fred Willard Magnificent Movie Trivia book. I am not running out of questions yet from this thing.
Huge shocker. Endless.
But I have to go with this, because he's got a whole section on historical epics. So what could be better? So, and yes, I've picked through these for the ones that I would know the answers to.
That's great, Jordan. Nice job. Something Mel Gibson said whenever I was watching the extras is that he really wanted to make a throwback to those kind of movies. He felt they hadn't been made in a really long time. And then this kind of kicked off a resurgence of those. And I think probably the best example and a film that's definitely akin to this one is Gladiator from 4 years later, which unfortunately we can't cover because it's from 2000. But there were a lot of Swords and Sandals movies for a little while. Not really anymore. It kind of faltered off again, but that's cool, Jordan. That's cool. Yes. Why don't you ask me your question first?
Sure. There was a gladiator question in here, but I felt like I should steer clear. I felt like you know that film too well for me to slip anything by you. There's also the question, in which historical film is William Wallace the central character? So I'm not going to ask you that one. I'm going to go with this one. Of which war is Last Samurai character Nathan Algren a veteran? Was it A, American Civil War, B, World War I, C, War of 1812, or D, Revolutionary War?
Was it the Civil War?
That's right. That's right. Tom Cruise, Civil War.
You know, I've never watched that, and I have it. My aunt got it for me on DVD and told me it was really good. And I thought, oh, that's cool. You know, I wasn't planning on watching this, but I think I will now. And I still haven't watched it. That was like 20 years ago. I knew it wasn't that long ago, but it was a while back. I need to watch it.
I remember enjoying it a lot. And I think it gets a lot of hate nowadays just for it being like, you know, the white savior mentality where you've got Tom Cruise as this Civil War vet who comes into the midst of this Japanese conflict and kind of like takes over and saves the day and kind of thing. But I don't know if that rubs you the wrong way or not, but as a story being told, I remember being really engaged and thought all the performances and the set pieces and everything were really well done. So I'd say give it a shot.
I really like Hiroyuki Sanada. I like him a lot. He was Scorpion in that Mortal Kombat that came out last year, but he's in a lot of other stuff. So I need to watch it.
Yeah, he's pretty great. Yeah, he's pretty great in it.
Right on. All right, enough of this small talk. It's time for your question.
Bring it.
Braveheart lost the Oscar for Best Screenplay written directly for the screen. Which of the other four nominees won? And I just want to tell you, I didn't misdirect any of these by just adding some crap that wasn't actually nominated. So there's everything here, there's no trick questions.
All right.
All right. So which did win Best Screenplay written directly for the screen that year? Was it A, The Usual Suspects, written by Christopher McQuarrie? Was it B, Mighty Aphrodite, written by Woody Allen? Was it C, Nixon, written by Oliver Stone, Christopher Wilkinson, or Stephen J. Revell? Or was it Toy Story, written by Joss Whedon and a whole lot of other people? Man, this is this list is as people would say now, pretty problematic. But hey, Usual Suspects, Mighty Aphrodite, Nixon, or Toy Story?
Was it Usual Suspects?
You got it, buddy. See? I thought you would know that one. That's why I asked it first. I thought that was the fairest one.
That's fair. That's fair. All right. Let's see if this is fair. Whom does Angelina Jolie play in the 2004 film Alexander? Is it A, Alexander's daughter? B, Alexander's sister? C, Alexander's mother? Or D, Alexander's lover?
She's his mom, dude.
She's his mom, dude. That's right. Director Oliver Stone wanted a strong, passionate woman to play Olympias, the mother of Alexander the Great. Stone chose Angelina Jolie, despite the fact that she was only a year older than son Colin Farrell.
What year did that come out?
2004.
Gosh, okay, so that was when I got my film degree. I took a class that it was mythology and historical, like sword and sandal epics, basically was the focus of it. And we did the Alexander the Great movie that was older, but I knew that because of that somehow.
Right.
I never watched it, though.
Funny how those things worked. Yeah, I didn't like it.
All right, next question. Braveheart also lost the award for Best Film Editing, even though it did win 5 Academy Awards. Which of these other four nominees won for Best Film Editing? Was it Apollo 13? Was it Babe? Was it Crimson Tide? Or was it 7?
I'm leaning towards either Apollo 13 or 7. I thought it was Apollo 13 first before you said 7. I'm going to go with 7.
No, we should have gone with your first instinct, man.
Oh, damn it.
Do you think the stodgy stick up our butts we only like to nominate sexual predators Academy would have given an award to Seven? No, they gave it to probably Apollo 13.
Yeah, you're
they
right.
They gave it to
yeah.
the prestige movie out of this group.
Yeah, the prestige safe choice should have gone
right.
with that.
Even though Seven's editing kicks Apollo 13 editing's ass, in my opinion. But yeah, that's just my opinion. All right, what you got?
All right, next question for historical epics. Who received a screen credit for directing Gone with the Wind from 1939? Was it A, Victor Fleming, B, George Cukor? I don't know if I said that right or not. Is it Cukor or Cukor? Let's go with Cukor. C, David O. Selznick, or D, Sam Wood?
Was it Fleming? A?
It was Fleming. Yes, sir. Nice. You got it.
It's a little bit of minutia that stuck in my brain.
There you go.
All right, my third question. Who hosted the stupid damn Oscars that year? Was it A, Whoopi Goldberg, B, Ted Danson, C, Billy Crystal, or D, David Letterman?
Before you said anybody's name, Billy Crystal was in mine, so I'm just going to go with Billy Crystal.
Wrong, buddy. It was Whoopi Goldberg.
Whoopi Goldberg.
Ah, what a shock.
Damn you, Whoopi Goldberg. Damn you to hell.
Right. Well, Jordan, you lost, but let me ask you the fourth question, please. I'm begging you.
Yes, I'll allow it.
Even though you lost already. Okay, the fourth question is, how many Oscar nominations did Batman Forever receive that year?
Oh, wow.
Was it A, 0, B, 1, C, 2, D, 3?
I'm going to go with the most outrageous answer and guess 3.
Yes, it was 3, Jordan.
What was it nominated for?
Jordan, it was nominated for Best Sound Effects Editing.
Yeah.
Braveheart won. The only other movie they nominated was Crimson Tide. Like, not 7. Like, not 7 for that.
Wow.
Not Apollo 13, which takes place in space for that. No. It was nominated in Best Sound, which Apollo 13 did win. Jordan, get this one. This is the best one of all. Braveheart won for Best Cinematography. Batman Forever, nominated for Best Cinematography.
Wow.
Wow. For 1995, Jordan.
That just proves everything you believe about the Oscars right there.
It really does. It really does. Which leads into the last question. Jordan, I hate the Oscars and I don't care about them. When was the last time I watched the Oscars? A, I've never watched them. B, 1999, when Saving Private Ryan lost to Shakespeare in Love. C, 2007, when Crash won Best Picture.
Yeah, 99.
Yeah, you're correct.
I think I read that on your blog.
It's true. It's so, true. Nice job, Jordan.
Yeah. Points for reading the Nick experiment. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. D was, I'm lying. I love them and I watch them every year, which is not true. That was the last time I watched.
Can I tell you this? I started to write my own trivia battle questions revolving around Brendan Gleeson, but I only got to one. Can I ask you my one Brendan Gleeson question?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So Brendan Gleeson was in Paddington 2, the highly praised movie from 2017 about a marmalade-loving bear. What was Gleeson's character name in the film? Was it A, Phoenix Buchanan, B, Knuckles McGinty, C, Colonel Lancaster, D, Mr. McGrubber, or E, Paddington?
Was it Knuckles McGinty?
It was Knuckles McGinty. Damn you, Nick. You get all my questions right, even not the real ones.
Oh, I could have made some money off of this, and yeah. That just shows you how much I don't want to succeed in life, that I haven't. But I watched that at the Grand Theater in Lafayette with my family. Took a day off in Lafayette and saw that there. It was a pretty good movie. Those Paddington movies are pretty
You know
good.
It's a great double feature? Paddington 2 and Braveheart.
You know, that Twitter account now that just photoshops Paddington and everything. I'm sure they've done Braveheart, but if they haven't, I'm sure they will.
Oh, I mean, let's just say this. Paddington 2 is a great film. Like, I seriously enjoyed it. I think it's a really well-made movie.
I love the first one. Sure, I'm in the minority here, but I actually liked the first one a little better. I thought the visuals were a little more creative in that one. And the second one I thought was a brilliant film, but I felt the visuals were slightly more derivative of other things. There's like a little bit more of a Wes Anderson vibe to that one. Now, again, I'm sure not many people will agree with me on that, but
I can totally see that. I can give you that for sure. Maybe that's why I like it so much, because I like that whole vibe. But all right, what am I being punished with again, Nick?
Well, Jordan, this is really exciting. So we just covered my mom's request, which is Braveheart. Again, happy birthday and thank you, Mom. I hadn't watched Braveheart in so long, and I enjoyed it so much, and I'm so glad that you requested that. But now we're going to cover your mother-in-law's request, Jordan. And it's quite different from the movie we just covered, because it's the John Waters film, Serial Mom, Jordan. We're going to watch Serial Mom, which you knew because it was requested by your mother-in-law. This is from 1994. I haven't seen this since the 90s, man. It's got Kathleen Turner in it.
I don't think I've ever seen it, yeah.
Our boy Matthew Lillard's in here, man.
Ooh, nice.
I'm really excited. I mostly remember Ricky Lake for whatever reason, but
I'm really excited to watch this. Yeah.
Right. And for punishment, I don't know, man. John Waters, for some reason when I was a kid, anytime I saw this guy, I thought, this is a safe person. Like, for some reason, this is a comforting presence to me.
You did, really?
I did. I don't know why. You know, I got really distracted reading his giant piece that he wrote about his encounter with Little Richard, who was his hero, and he was going to write a piece for him in Playboy magazine, and it was an insane piece and so well written. That's probably my biggest John Waters experience next to watching Serial Mom in the 90s. But you know what? We're going to have a total John Waters episode, because he made three movies in the 90s, and one of them, besides Serial Mom, was 1998's Pecker, Jordan. Pecker. It's called Pecker. I just remember in high school, like junior year, when that came out in 1998, people were like, hey, you going to go see Pecker? And none of us were going to go see Pecker, but we liked telling other people that they were going to go see Pecker because they like peckers, because that's what you say in the late 90s in the 11th grade.
That's what you say when you're a dude, brah, in the mid-90s, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Hey, you going to go see Pecker?
So yeah, you're gonna watch Pecker from 1998, and I always watch the punishment movie, not always, but I watch them a lot, and I'm sure I'm gonna watch this too.
I feel like I have seen this at some point. It's one of the few John Waters movies, other than like Crybaby, which is, you know, kind of more ubiquitous than any of those, that I've seen, because I hadn't seen Serial Mom, but yeah, somehow I've seen Pecker and Crybaby. So yeah, this will be a good double feature. Get to know John Waters a little bit more, see how safe he is.
Isn't it just called Pecker because the dude's name is Pecker in the movie?
I think so, yeah. I don't think it has anything to do with genitalia.
Gotcha. If, for anyone wandering, maybe your mind is wandering because we've been talking for 2 hours, but wondering who's in Pecker, it stars Edward Furlong, you know, from T2. It's got Christina Ricci.
Which I like a lot. Yeah, I like him a lot, yeah. And yeah, Ricci, like her a lot.
Yeah, man. Martha Plimpton from The Goonies and from Raising Hope, which is a Fox sitcom that came on in the last decade. That was really good. So Lily Taylor's in this.
Lily Taylor, great 90s actress. She's great, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to, even though I'm punishing you with this, I'm looking forward to watching it.
I think, yeah, this is just a nice way to double bill some John Waters, so I'll take it. I'll take it. All right, well, yeah, if you guys want to join us in watching those movies for next time, please do. And as always, if you have any comments about the show, you can email us at filmshakepodcast@gmail.com.
I suggest that you complain that we didn't talk about the Braveheart techno remix.
There's a Braveheart techno remix?
There is. So if anyone wants to write in to complain that we didn't talk about that, go for it. You could even leave us a 5-star review on iTunes and say, I wish they talked about the Braveheart techno remix.
I'm going to write that review because I did not know about this. Maybe we can have that as the outro right here.
Oh, I'm going to cut out you saying that, but I was already planning on doing that. It's 100% the outro for this episode.
All right. I'll take it. Good deal. Well, we'll catch you next time for more Film Shake.
Take it easy.
I'm not even gonna try it. Okay.
Give up.
With the historical stuff.